What effect did Islam have upon your parents and family? Can you tell us whether your family members converted to Islam or not? What happened with regards to my immediate family is that my parents accepted Islam in 1994, that is 3 years ago. They accepted Islam, and I accepted Islam in 1972. So what we're talking about is 22 years. So this is like advice also to those who may have accepted Islam also and trying with their parents and feel very frustrated, you know, that their parents are not responding, that one has to be patient. You know, when they are ready, then they will accept Islam. If it is that they want the truth for themselves, to live according to that truth, our duty is only to convey that message to them and to ask God to open their hearts. And we have to be patient. We have to show them, not only in our words, what Islam is, but we also have to show them, more importantly, in our deeds. The question with regards to my name, you're called Abu Amina. You know, Abu Amina means the father of Amina, meaning that my eldest child, her name is Amina, so I took the kunya, or pet name, Abu Amina. The name which I chose was Bilal, and my family name, Philip. Some people question, well, why are you keeping this family name, Philip? You know, it's not an Islamic name. Well, according to Islamic law, when a person accepts Islam, they may change their given name, but the family name should not be changed, because it represents one's family. When a person becomes a Muslim, it doesn't mean that they no longer are part of the family that they were born into. They're no longer the son or daughter of their parents. So it is not permissible that the family name be changed, regardless of what that family name is. We know when we speak of Prophet Muhammad, may God speak and bless and upon him, we refer to his grandfather, Abdul Muttalib, which means the slave or worshipper or servant of Al-Muttalib, an individual Al-Muttalib, which is, as a Muslim, an unacceptable name. One may not choose this name. To call oneself Abdul Muttalib is a forbidden name. But if that's the name of one's parent, then we're not allowed to change that name. My name prior to Islam was Dennis, and this name I could not keep. There's some non-Islamic names or non-Arabic names which a person may have, John, for example. You know, it doesn't have any bad meaning, so one can keep a name like this, or Mary, you know, or other names from which may be found in the Bible, or whose meaning is not bad. One is not required to change even the given name. But where the name has a bad meaning, for example, for women, the name Diana, for example. Diana is the goddess of love in Greek, Roman mythology. So for a Muslim to have this name, it's not acceptable. Similarly, Venus comes from Dionysius. Dionysius is one of the Greek gods of party. So, it's not an acceptable name, so I changed this name. But, you know, I remain Bilal, the son of Bradley Phillips. My father's name is Bradley Phillips, and so my name has remained as such. Now, with regards to the rest of members of my family, my brother and sister, were non-Muslims, neither have accepted Islam. However, the other two members of the group that I was in Sabah, so many years back, I came to find out last year when I went to Sabah that both of them also accepted Islam. They had accepted Islam on their own. One of them had come to Australia and accepted Islam here in Australia, and the other one had accepted Islam there in Sabah. So last year was quite a nice reunion for me with my old friends. Actually, what happened was I was giving lectures in Abu Dhabi, in UAE, and one of the people who attended the lectures there had gotten some of my books and took them back to Sabah. He was from Sabah. And when his brothers and sisters saw these books and saw the name on it, Philip, born in Jamaica, from Canada, and so they said, I wonder if it's the same, you know, Dennis Phillips who we used to know. So he asked them to come back and ask me. Of course, when he asked me, I told him, yes, I was. And they were quite overjoyed to hear that I'd become Muslim. And they invited me to come down there for a series of lectures. One of them had become the head of the Inner Sabah security, climate security organ there in Sabah. And my old classmates, we had quite a reunion, all my old classmates and friends. Some of my non-Muslim friends I had a chance also to sit with and try to give them some encouragement to reflect on Islam with the idea of possibly accepting it. There's a question regarding my acceptance of Islam. One person questioned the issue of using the term convert to Islam. I know there's something of a debate about whether we should say revert or convert. And I found it to be really something of semantics. I left what I believe in, or a way of life which I had inherited, and chose another one. Whatever you want to call it, that's what I did. Another person asked, well, what did you know about Christ before you became a Muslim? To be honest, not very much. Beyond that he was the Son of God, and he was God. As I guess most Christians tend to know, I came to know more about Christianity after having become a Muslim and looking at it again, you know, what it's believed to, etc. There's another question, why it was that I chose Islam and not seek my answers in Christianity. Well, because I had left Christianity because of the fact that what I knew of Christianity didn't address social ills in terms of dealing with society from a governmental point of view, etc. There was no economic system or anything. I mean, it's just beliefs, an issue of beliefs. You know, there may be nice moral beliefs, etc., but they don't address the world. It is leave unto God what is God's and unto Caesar what is Caesar's. This is the approach. This is not a practical approach in terms of changing society. So I knew that the answers in terms of systems wasn't there in Christianity. This is why I didn't go back to seek those answers, because having converted to communism, I did have a look at Christianity at the time, and in terms of what systems had developed out of it, and really the conclusion which the Marxists had made, that religion is the opiate of the masses or the people, was drawn from the example of Christianity in Europe and how it was applied. And it was a means of convincing the ignorant masses that their reward is in the next life. Don't worry about this life. The rulers who are over you are by God's will. They are in fact closer to God. It's possible, if you have more money, to buy tickets to paradise, known as the indulgences, which the Pope used to sell during the Middle Ages. This whole tradition led these philosophers to conclude that religion is the opiate of the people. And that tradition, Christian tradition, remains the same till today. It doesn't address the ills of society in a solid and reliable way, from my experience. I see it modifying itself with the times, so much so that we now have, in different parts of America, you know, homosexual priests, you know, homosexual congregations, you know. This is homosexuality, which was an abomination in Christianity in earlier times, has become acceptable in the eyes of many Christians today, Christian leading religious people. You know, there's this backtracking, there's the stability of concepts are even questionable. So, I would say that I've understood more about Christ and Christianity having become a Muslim than I ever understood as a Christian. And I have no qualms in saying that the only way that a person may truly follow Jesus is to become a Muslim. I've written a book called The True Message of Jesus Christ, it is available, in which I have gathered research to that effect, to show some scriptures, Islamic as well as some Christian scriptures, that the message which Jesus brought was Islam, submission to the will of God. And that is the way which he invited people to, was the way of Islam. And that he himself was in fact a prophet of God and not God. What do you like about Islam in simple terms? The completeness. That it is a total system. It is a way of life which governs all aspects of my life. It provides guidance for me in a world of darkness. Prior to Islam, I know I was stumbling about, not knowing which way I was going, just whatever came up, I checked this out, checked that out, you know, stumbling, bumbling, back and forth. Islam provided stability, provided a clear picture with regards to what this world is about, where I should be going, and what my goals should be. So it has given me inner contentment. I don't feel at ease that I still have to go and find, no. I feel that I found the truth. And I really have no doubt about it. I try to study it as deeply as I could, not merely accepting it and just going along with what everybody said, but having studied it academically. I really, as I said, have no doubt about the fact that Islam is the way of life which God has described for human beings. The question regarding the soldiers as to why so many of them accepted Islam, the fact is that there are many reasons. Some of it was that they were exposed to Islamic society or Muslim society, which, you know, though it has its weaknesses, no one is saying that Saudi Arabia is the ideal Muslim society, it may be quite far from it, but there are strong elements of Islam there in the society, and this had an effect on a number of the soldiers. Some of it may be from the very customs of the people. I know a number of them told me that when they were out on the desert in maneuvers, you know, with their full battle gear and everything, and would be out in the desert, and they would come across a tent with a few camels, an individual Bedouin out there in the desert. And the first reaction they expected is that this person would run in horror from them. You know, they were all geared down with all their stuff. But they found instead that the individual would beckon to them to come over. Come sit down. They would come up, sit down. You couldn't distinguish the men from the women. You know, everybody was all geared down. And he would strike up the fire and put on some tea, offer them some dates. Since he couldn't speak any English, they couldn't speak any Arabic, he would just smile and offer them and so forth. Amazed, you know, here. You know, just, I know a number of them said this to me. It struck them, you know, this generosity and kindness that was there, you know, which they said that they never experienced. You know, having been in a number of other parts of the world, in Korea, in Japan, in Europe, you know, different places that they were stationed, they never found this kind of friendliness and openness, you know, amongst the people. So I know this really struck them, a number of them. Others had been exposed to Islam in one way or another in American society. We had a lot of distortions, and so we had open sessions where people could ask any questions they wanted to, and so a lot of classification was there, which helped to let them understand what Islam really was. There were some who were impressed by the security which was there in the society. In other words, to come into town late at night when they were off duty, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, and they could walk around without a sense of fear that, you know, they're going to be attacked, you know, somebody's going to rob them, whatever. And this had an impression on a number of them. So they, back in America, they know they could never do this. They walk around at that camp at night, you know, wearing any kind of jewelry or anything like this. Would be putting oneself in a life-threatening circumstance. For others, there was the execution. I know some people might say, horrible, you know, because there people are being executed, the public executions that take place there. The crime is read out and, you know, people observe somebody's head being cut off. For some people, that was something which made them want to question, want to understand more about Islam, and this sort of direct justice, you know, where a person kills somebody and they're executed, finished. They don't languish in jail for many, many years, people's taxes having to pay for them, provide them with television, comfortable living for, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. But this idea of the eye for the eye made sense to them, and it attracted them. For a number, it was the issues concerning women. You know, many coming there had the impression that women are, you know, so oppressed in Islam, and also seeing the women wearing these abaya, the black abayas, you know, totally covered, walking through the streets. The troops had developed a site for them, you know, you have UFOs, unidentified flying objects. They call them the UBOs, right? The unidentified black objects, you know. So, you know, they're curious as to what was behind all of this. So, a number of the women, they were taken into Saudi homes, and they got to meet Saudi women and discuss with them. They were educated, could speak with them, etc. And they came to understand that Islam's position was one of protection as opposed to one of oppression. For some, it was the issues of prayer and how the prayer was. That when the time for prayer came, the stores all closed and people went to prayer. A number of them had been told that the mosques were off limits, they shouldn't, you know, go near them. But, you know, we invited them to come to the mosque, we took them in, let them go and see what's inside the mosque, you know, because by telling them it was off limits, it sort of left it as a big question mark in their minds, you know, what goes on inside there. So it's quite impressive for a number of them to come in and see it. It's such a simple kind of atmosphere. There's not a whole bunch of pictures and statues and things like this, but just a carpet, you know, and they saw how the prayer was, etc. And this had an impression on a number of people who were there. For some people, it was an issue of religious discussion. You know, although in our main tent, we didn't really entertain that much in the way of direct religious discussion. If the topic was light, we'd give light clarifications. But if it got really heavy, people wanted to get into Bible verses and all this type of things. We had a second tent, which was next to our main tent. The main tent was quite large, about 200 used to come in at a time, and we'd have these open discussions. So we had this separate tent. When the people decided they want to get into this deep, you know, theological debate, we tell them, okay, listen, you know, this is a light discussion. If you really want to get into deep theology, then we have the other tent. You can go over into this other tent. So when they went into the other tent, they were greeted by this Sri Lankan brother, very tall, imposing brother with a big beard and used the word sunglasses. So he looked like a holy man, you know, he has a holy man look about him. He had originally come to Saudi Arabia, you know, as a Christian missionary, you know, having studied, you know, in a seminary, and having understood that the last frontier were the Muslims, right, and particularly the Arab Muslims, and particularly in the Gulf, in Saudi Arabia, because this is a place where just absolutely no conversion. So he was, you know, one of these kind of pioneering kind of souls. He thought, this is where I'm going. So he got a job as an accountant, because he'd been trained accountant, but his real role there was missionary work amongst the Arabs. And when he got there, of course, he got himself a Quran, because he felt he wanted to be fully versed. He had studied it when he was doing his basic studies. When he converted, he decided to convert one of the organizations in Qasim, which is involved in explaining Islam to non-Muslims, took him out of his job, provided a source of income for him, and gave him a free hand to, you know, spread the word in different parts of Saudi Arabia, in the camps and various organizations that were available for conveying Islam to non-Muslims. Now, he was, as I said, from a Christian missionary training. He had a good thorough knowledge of the Bible. And as such, he had the kind of background to deal with the issues that these people were bringing. He would wait for them there. He had two suitcases with him. He used to carry two suitcases around with him. And these two suitcases had in them about 40 different versions of the Bible. So when they would come in and sit down, he would open up the suitcase and say, well, which Bible do you want to discuss about? Many of them say, what do you mean, which Bible? There's only one Bible. So he'd bring out for them and stack them all up and say, well, you know, we have this Bible and that Bible and the other Bible. You know, that was usually quite intimidating for many, you know. At any case, either he convinced them, you know, after some discussion, or they said, well, listen, okay, we don't have answers, but let's go get our chaplain, you know, he'll have some answers for you, questions, or answers to your questions. So they would go back and bring the chaplain, and alhamdulillah, in the course of discussion, 11 of the chaplains converted to Islam. So these were the basic circumstances under which Islam spread amongst the troops. Some of them, actually, there were other members of their families that were already Muslims, and they had curiosity, you know, they were quite open. And to be honest, actually, the vast majority of those who converted were Americans from a variety of different backgrounds, you know, a mixture of men, women, young, old, black, white. Actually, the percentage of white Americans who accepted was someplace around 35%, which is much higher than those who would normally accept Islam in America itself. And this really shows that if Islam is exposed to the American population as a whole, there would be a lot greater response to Islam in America. And we had people who accepted Islam who were Chinese Americans, Indian Americans. We even had some devil worshippers, you know, who had come who accepted Islam. You know. Because actually, you know, the American military recognizes devil worship as a legitimate form of worship. And wherever there are chapels for the Christian sects, then there are chapels for devil worshippers on all American military bases. The reaction in the military, you know, amongst the chaplains was quite strong, you know, because the tent came to be known as the conversion tent, you know. And they tried their darndest to get the military officials to stop or to make it off bounds to the American troops. But the big officers, etc., wouldn't agree with their suggestion because of the fact that they had such a large number of troops and they didn't have for them the kind of R&R which they normally would have when they're in Japan or, you know, the other places where they could go to discos and, you know, and all these kind of things. These things were not available to them. You know, women, all these kind of things. It's not available. So, if they didn't allow the troops some outlets, you know, the troops wanted outlets. They wanted to find out about Islam, meet the people, and so on and so forth. If they didn't allow this, they felt that the repercussions may be much greater. You know, that they may, you know, commit some crimes in the society and this would create, you know, major problems for themselves. So, though I'm sure they were not necessarily happy about, you know, conversion of American troops to Islam, they really didn't have too many options given the circumstance. Because after they left, you know, according to American military records, so this is the first place that American troops were stationed. And they left the country without any quote-unquote war babies. You know, war babies. Americans, when they came to the Asia during the Vietnam War, they left behind, you know, in Vietnam, in Philippines, in Korea, in Japan, in Thailand, war babies. I mean, babies who are half American, you know, half of the locals. In fact, there's big cases going on in the Philippines right now for the rights of these children. So the first time, they went into a country, half a million of them, and went out, and there were no war babies. In fact, the only pregnancies which they found were amongst the American troops themselves. Many of the women that were there went back pregnant. So the tent was functioning right up until they left. And the American military continues to leave the door open for those military people who want to get information about Islam. The British military, on the other hand, were very close. The officers would not allow us to go and speak to the troops at all. So there were very, very few British military people who accepted Islam. What happened also is that Hajj and Umrah was arranged for those who came. A number of troops were taken down to Mecca for Hajj and Umrah, and a system whereby American military transportation was provided for American troops in different parts of the world. They are flown into Bahrain, and from there, the Saudi military have arranged for them to go yearly for Hajj. This is an ongoing process since that time. Some questions concerning school of thought, because I mentioned during the course of the lecture that initially I announced that I was a Hanafi. One person asked me, are you still a Hanafi? Do you follow any mazhab, I guess, huh? And what did you find in your research about the different schools of thought in Islam? To which school of thought do you belong and why? Well, I consider myself a follower of all of the major schools of thought. The major school of thought meaning the school of Abu Hanifa, of Malik, of Shafi'i, and Ahmad ibn Hanbal, the major scholars of after whom the schools were named. I take benefit from the efforts that they have made, and wherever the authentic evidence supports their positions, that's what I follow. And this is a position held by themselves. Both Abu Hanifa and Shafi'i were both quoted as saying, إِذَا صَحَّ الْحَدِيثُ فَهُوَ مَذْهَبِي. That if you find the authentic tradition from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, may God peace and blessing be upon him, this in fact is the madhab or school of thought. Follow all of the schools without giving any precedence to one over the other, except with regards to where the evidence is. سبحانك اللهم وبحمدك نشهد ان لا اله الا انت نستغفرك ونتوب اليك. السلام عليكم ورحمه الله وبركاته.